said, "Tomorrow." Marsh said, "Mr. Earp, I thought we had a deal." "It's amazing," Earp said, "how things keep changing in this world." "But you don't even know if this young man can come up with the money." "I suspect he can."
$800, Johnson said. Half an hour later, Marsh pronounced himself happy to take Earp's share of the bones, at once and without inspection, for $1,000 in cash. "But I want that box," he said suddenly, spying the one with the small X on the side. "That means something." "No!" yelled Johnson. Marsh drew his weapon.
"It would appear that box has contents that are especially valuable. And if you believe that your life is also especially valuable, Mr. Johnson, which I do not, then I suggest you let me remove this crate without further discussion."
Marsh had the boxes loaded onto a wagon, and he and Navy Joe Benedict headed north, toward Deadwood, to retrieve the rest of the bones.
"What does he mean, the rest of the bones?" Johnson asked, as he saw the wagon drive off into the sunset.
"I told him there was another £1,000 we left behind in Deadwood, hidden in Chinesetown, only you didn't want him to know about them," Earp said.
"We better get moving," Johnson said. "He won't go far before he cracks open one of those cases and finds he has bought worthless granite. And he'll be back hopping mad."
"I'm ready to go," Earp said, thumbing through the money. "I feel well satisfied with my return on this trip."
"There's one problem, of course."
"You need crates to replace the ones you just lost," said Earp. "I bet the army garrison has some, given their need for provisions."
Within an hour, they had procured 10 crates of more or less equal size as the ones Marsh had taken. Johnson unearthed the bones from their manure bed and packed them carefully but quickly. The box containing the dragon teeth received another axe, which satisfied him more than he could say. They left, within minutes, for Cheyenne.
Earp was up on the box with Tiny. Inside the coach, Miss Emily stared at him.
"Well?"
"Well what?"
"I think I've been very patient."
"I thought you might be Wyatt's girl," he said.
"Wyatt's girl? Wherever would you get an idea like that?"
"Well, I thought so."
"Wyatt Earp is a scoundrel and a drifter. The man lives for excitement, gambling, shooting, and other pursuits of no substance."
"And me?"
"You're different," she said. "You're brave. But you were also refined. I bet you kiss real refined, too."
She was waiting. "I learned," Johnson wrote in his journal, "one immediate lesson, which was the unwisdom of kissing aboard a bucking stagecoach. My lip was deeply bitten and the blood flowed freely, which inhibited, but did not stop, further explorations of this nature." He added, "I hope she did not know I had never kissed a girl before, in the passionate French way which seemed to be to her liking, except for that one time with Lucienne. But I will say this for Emily. If she did know, she did not say anything. And for that, and for other experiences with her in Cheyenne, I am eternally grateful."
Cheyenne. In the unimaginable splendor of a room at the Interocean Hotel, which he had previously seen as a roach-infested dump, Johnson took his ease for several days with Emily. But first, upon arrival and signing the hotel register, he ascertained that the Interocean maintained a steel-walled strongroom with one of the new combination time locks developed for banks against would-be bank robbers. The boxes were carried into the room by the porters. He tipped them generously so that they would not resent him and whisper about the boxes to their less friendly colleagues. The first day he soaked in 4 baths in succession, for after each he found his body was still dirty. It seemed as though the dust of the prairie would never leave his skin. He visited the barber,
who trimmed his hair and beard. It was startling to sit in the chair and inspect his own face in the mirror. He could not get used to it. His features were unfamiliar. He had the face of a different person. Leaner, harder, determination now in his features. And there was the scar over his upper lip. He rather liked it, and so did Emily. The barber stepped back, scissors in one hand, comb in the other. "How's that look, sir?" Like everyone else in Cheyenne, the barber treated Johnson with respect. It wasn't because he was rich. No one in Cheyenne knew he was rich, but rather because of something in his manner, his bearing. Without meaning to do so, he looked like a man who might shoot another one, because he now had. "Sir, how does that look?" the barber asked again. Johnson didn't know. Finally, he said, "I like it fine." He took Emily to dinner in the best restaurant in town. They dined on oysters from California, and wine from France, and poulet à l'estragon. She recognized the name of the wine, he noticed. After dinner, they walked arm in arm on the streets of the town. He remembered how dangerous Cheyenne had felt when he had been here before. Now it seemed a sleepy little railway junction, populated by braggarts and gamblers putting on airs. Even the toughest-looking customers stepped aside on the boardwalk when he passed. "They see you wear a gun," Emily said, "and you know how to use it." Pleased, Johnson took Emily back to the hotel early, and to bed. They stayed in bed most of the following day. He had a wonderful time, and so did she. "Where will you go now?" she asked him on the third day. "Back to Philadelphia," he said. "I've never been to Philadelphia," she said. "You'll love it there," he said, smiling. She smiled back, happily. "You really want me to come?" "Of course." "Really?" "Don't be silly," he said. But he began to feel that she was always one step ahead of him. She seemed to know the hotel better than he would have expected, and enjoyed an easy over-familiarity with the men behind the desk and the waiters in the dining room. Some even seemed to recognize her, and when he and Emily strolled the streets and window-shopped, she recognized Eastern fashions readily. "I think this one's very pretty." "It seems out of place here. Not that I am the expert." "Well, a Western girl likes to know what's fashionable." He would have reason to ponder this statement later. A few steps along the wooden walkway, she said, "What sort of person is your mother?" Johnson had not thought of his mother for a long time. The very thought was jolting in some way. "Why did you ask that?" "I was just wondering about meeting her."
"How do you mean?"
"Whether she will like me."
"Ah, of course.
Do you think she'll like me, Bill?"
"Oh, she'll like you fine," Johnson said. "You don't sound convinced." She pouted prettily.
"Don't be silly," he said, and squeezed her arm. "Let's go back to the hotel," she said, and quickly she licked his ear.
"Stop it, Emily."
"What's the matter?
I thought you liked that."
"I do, but not here. Not in public."
"Why?"
"Nobody's looking at us."
"I know, but it's not proper."
"What difference does it make?"
She was frowning.
"If nobody is looking at us, what possible difference could it make?"
"I don't know.
It just does."
"You're back in Philadelphia already," she said, stepping away and staring at him.
"Now, Emily, you are..."
But all he said was, "Don't be silly."
"I'm not being silly," she said, "and I'm not going to Philadelphia."
He did not know what to say.
"I just wouldn't fit in," she said,
wiping a tear from her cheek.
"Emily,"
she cried openly. "I know what you were thinking, Bill. I've known for days now."
"Emily, please."
He had no idea what she meant,
for the last 3 days had been the most deliriously pleasurable of his life. "It's no good. Don't touch me, please. It's no good, that's all."
They walked back to the hotel, side by side, not speaking. She held her head high and sniffled occasionally. He was uncomfortable, clumsy, not knowing what to do. After a time, he glanced at her and saw that she was no longer crying. She was furious.
"After all I did for you," she said, "why, you'd be long dead from Dick if I hadn't helped you. And you'd never have gotten out of Deadwood if I hadn't talked Wyatt into helping you. And you'd have lost your bones in Laramie if I hadn't helped you see a plan."
"That's true, Emily. And this is the thanks I get. You cast me aside like an old rag." She was really angry.
Yet somehow he realized it was he who was being cast aside.
"Emily, I said don't touch me."
It was a relief when the sheriff came up to them, tipped his hat politely to Emily, and said, "You William Johnson of Philadelphia?"
"I am."
"You the one staying at the Interocean?"
"I am."
"You have some identification of who you are?"
"Of course."
"That's fine," the sheriff said, taking out his gun. "You're under arrest for the murder of William Johnson."
"But I am William Johnson."
"I can't see how. William Johnson is dead. So whoever you are, you're surely not him, are you?" Handcuffs were snapped on his wrists. He looked at her.
"Emily, tell him."
Emily turned on her heel and walked away without a word. "Emily!"
"Let's go, mister," the sheriff said, and pushed Johnson toward the jail.
It took a while for the details to come out. His first day in Cheyenne, Johnson had cabled his father in Philadelphia, asking him to send $500. His father had immediately cabled the sheriff's office to report that someone in Cheyenne was impersonating his dead son. Everything Johnson produced, his Yale class ring, some crumpled correspondence, a newspaper clipping from the Deadwood Black Hills Weekly Pioneer, was taken as proof that he had robbed a dead man and probably killed him as well. "This fella Johnson's a college man from back east," the sheriff said, squinting judiciously at Johnson. "Now that couldn't be you, could it?"
"But it is," Johnson insisted.
"He's rich, too."
"I am,"
the sheriff laughed.
"That's a good one," he said. "You're a rich college man from back east, and I'm Santa Claus."
"Ask the girl. Ask Emily."
"Oh, I did," the sheriff said. "She said she's real disappointed in you. You gave her a big story about yourself, and now she sees you for what you are. She's living it up in your hotel room and selling off those crates or whatever it is you brought with you to town."
"What?"
"She's no friend of yours, mister," the sheriff said.
"She can't sell those crates."
"I don't see why not. She says they're hers."
"They're mine!"
"It's no good getting all hot like this," the sheriff said. "I checked with some folks come down from Deadwood. Seems you showed up there with a dead Indian and a dead white man. I lay you 100 to 1 that white man was William Johnson."
Johnson started to explain, but the sheriff held up his hand.
"I'm sure you got a story to explain it," he said. "Your type always does."
The sheriff went out of the jail. Johnson heard the deputy say, "Who is that fella?"
"Some desperado putting on airs," the sheriff said, and he went out for a drink.
The deputy was a boy of 16. Johnson traded him his boots to send a second telegram to Philadelphia. "Sheriff will be mighty angry if he finds out," the deputy said. "He wants you to go to Yankton to be tried for murder."
"Just send it," Johnson said, writing quickly. "Dear Father, sorry I wrecked yacht. Remember pet squirrel summer 71. Mother's fever after Edward born. Headmaster Ellis warning at Exeter. I am truly alive and you are causing great trouble. Send money and inform sheriff.
Your loving son, Pinky.
The deputy read the telegram slowly, mouthing the words. He looked up.
Pinky?
Just send it, Johnson said.
Pinky?
That was my name as a baby. The deputy shook his head. But he sent the telegram.
Now, look here, Mr. Johnson, the sheriff said, unlocking the cell a few hours later. It was an honest mistake. I was only doing my duty.
You got the telegram, Johnson said.
I got 3 telegrams, the sheriff said. One from your father, one from Senator Cameron of Pennsylvania, and one from Mr. Hayden at the Geological Survey in Washington. For all I know, there are more coming. I'm telling you, it was an honest mistake.
That's fine, Johnson said.
No hard feelings?
But Johnson had other things on his mind. Where's my gun?
He found Emily in the lobby of the Interocean Hotel. She was drinking wine.
Where are my crates?
I have nothing to say to you.
What have you done with my crates, Emily?
Nothing. She shook her head. They are just old bones. Nobody wants them.
Relieved, Johnson collapsed in a chair beside her.
I can't see why they are so important to you, she said.
They are, that's all.
Well, I hope you got some money, because the hotel is asking for the bill, and my smiling at the desk man is wearing thin.
I have money. My father sent...
She wasn't listening, however, but staring across the room past him. Her eyes lit up.
Collis!
Johnson turned to look. Behind him, a heavy-set, dour man in a dark suit was checking into the hotel at the front desk. The man looked over. He had the mournful expression of a basset hound.
Miranda? Miranda Lapham?
Johnson frowned.
Miranda?
Emily was standing, beaming. Collis Huntington, whatever are you doing in Cheyenne?
Bless me. It's Miranda Lapham.
Miranda? Lapham, Johnson said, not only confused by Emily's new name, but by the sudden idea that he might not have known her real identity at all. And why had she lied to him? The heavy-set man embraced Emily with warm and lingering familiarity.
Why, Miranda, you look wonderful. Simply wonderful.
It's delightful to see you, Collis.
Let me look at you, he said, stepping back, beaming.
You haven't changed a bit, Miranda.
I don't mind telling you I've missed you, Miranda.
And I you, Collis.
The heavy man turned to Johnson. This beautiful young lady is the best lobbyist the railroads ever had in Washington.
Johnson said nothing. He was still trying to put it together.
Collis Huntington, Washington. Railroads.
My God.
Collis Huntington. One of the big 4 of the Central Pacific in California. Collis Huntington, the blatant corruptionist who traveled each year to Washington with a suitcase full of money for the congressman, the man once described as scrupulously dishonest.
Everyone misses you, Miranda, Huntington went on. They all ask for you still.
Bob Arthur.
Dear Senator Arthur.
And Jack Kearns.
Commissioner Kearns, what a dear man.
And even the general.
The general? He still asks for me?
He does, Huntington said sadly, shaking his head.
Why don't you come back, Miranda? Washington was always your first love.
All right, she said suddenly. You've convinced me.
Huntington turned to Johnson.
Aren't you going to introduce me to your companion?
He's nobody, Miranda Lapham said, shaking her head so her curls moved prettily. She took Huntington's arm.
Come, Collis. We'll have a delicious lunch, and you can tell me the news of Washington.
And there is so much to do.
You will have to find me a house, of course, and I will need some setting up.
They moved away, arm in arm, to the dining room.
Johnson sat there, stunned.
At 8 the next morning, feeling he had lived a decade in a few months, he took the Union Pacific train east, all 10 crates stored in the rattling luggage car. The monotony of the voyage was most enjoyable, and he marked the greening of the landscape. The arrival of autumn could be seen in the top leaves of the oaks and maples and apple trees. At each stop, he would get off and buy the local newspapers, noticing an eastern point of view creeping into the editorials about the Indian Wars and various other topics. On the morning of the fourth day, in Pittsburgh, he telegraphed Cope to say he had survived and would like to come speak with him. He said nothing about the crates of bones. Then he telegraphed his parents and asked that they have an extra place set for dinner that night. He arrived in Philadelphia on October 8th. Four meetings. At the train station, Johnson hired a man with an empty greengrocer's wagon to take him to Cope's house on Pine Street in Philadelphia. It wasn't a long trip, and he arrived to find that Cope owned two matching three-story stone row houses, one a residence and the other a private museum and offices. Most surprising was that Cope lived perhaps only 7 or 8 blocks from Rittenhouse Square, where Johnson's mother was even now preparing for his arrival. "Which house is the residence?" he asked the wagon owner. "I do not know, but I think that fellow will tell you," the man said, pointing. It was Cope himself, bouncing down the steps. "Johnson!" "Professor!" He gave Johnson a firm handshake and a decisively strong hug.
"You're alive, and—"
He spied the tarp over the back of the wagon.
"Is it possible?"
Johnson nodded. "It wasn't impossible," is perhaps my best answer. The crates were taken directly into the museum half of Cope's property. Mrs. Cope came in with lemonade and wafers, and they sat down. They oohed over his stories, fussed over his appearance, exclaimed over his crates of bones. "I will want to have a secretary transcribe an entire account of your adventure," said Cope. "We need to be able to prove that the bones we excavated in Montana are the bones that sit now in Philadelphia." "A few may have broken from the way the wagon and stages bounced around," Johnson said. "Plus there may be a few bullet holes or bone chips. But mostly they're all here."
"The brontosaurus teeth?"
Cope asked, his hands twitching in excitement.
"Do you still have the teeth?
It may not reflect well on me,
but I have been worrying about this since the day we thought you had been killed."
"It's this crate here, Professor," Johnson said, finding the box with the X. Cope unpacked it on the spot, lifted the teeth one by one, and stared at them for a very long time, transfixed. He set them down in a row, much as he had done on the Shale Cliff many weeks earlier, nearly 2,000 miles to the west.
"This is extraordinary," he said. "Quite extraordinary.
Marsh will be hard put to match it for many years."
"Edward," said Mrs. Cope, "hadn't we better send Mr. Johnson home to his family?"
"Yes, of course," Cope said. "They must be eager to see you." His father embraced him warmly.
"I thank God for your return, son."
His mother stood at the top of the stairs and said weepily,
"The beard makes you look frightfully common, William. Get rid of it at once."
"What's happened to your lip?" his father said. "Are you wounded?"
"Indians," Johnson said. "Looks like teeth marks to me," Edward, his brother, said.
"That's so," Johnson said. "This Indian climbed aboard the wagon and bit me. Wanted to see what I would taste like."
"Bit you on the lip? What, was he trying to kiss you?"
"They are savages," Johnson said, "and unpredictable."
"Kissed by an Indian,"
Edward said, clapping his hands.
"Kissed by an Indian!"
Johnson rolled up his trousers and showed everyone the scar where the arrow had pierced his leg. He produced the stump of the arrow. He chose not to tell them many details. and said nothing of Emily Williams or Miranda Lapham or whatever her true name was. He did tell them about burying Toad and Little Wind. Edward burst into tears and ran upstairs to his room.
"We're just glad to have you back, son," his father said, looking suddenly much older.
The fall term was already underway, but the dean of Yale College permitted him to enroll anyway. Johnson was not above the dramatic effect of putting on his Western clothes and his gun, and striding into the dining room. The entire room fell silent. Then someone said,
"It's Johnson. Willie Johnson."
Johnson strode over to Marlin's table. Marlin was eating with friends. "I believe you owe me money," Johnson said, in his best, tough voice.
"How colorful you look," Marlin said, laughing. "You must introduce me to your tailor, William."
Johnson said nothing.
"Should I presume you had many dime Western adventures and killed men in actual gunfights?" Marlin said, hamming it up for their listeners.
"Yes," Johnson said. "That would be correct." Marlin's antic smile dropped, unsure of Johnson's meaning.
"I believe you owe me money," Johnson said again.
"My dear fellow, I owe you nothing at all. If you remember, the terms of our bet were that you would accompany Professor Marsh, and the entire school knows you did not get far with him before he cast you aside as a rogue and scoundrel."
In a single swift movement, Johnson grabbed Marlin by the collar, effortlessly hoisted him to his feet, and slammed him against the wall.
"You snotty little bastard. You give me that $1,000 or I'll break your head open."
Marlin was gasping and noticed Johnson's scar.
"I don't know you."
"No, but you owe me. Now tell everybody what you were going to do."
"I'm going to pay you $1,000.
Louder. Marlin repeated it loudly. The room laughed. Johnson dropped him in a crumpled heap to the floor and walked out of the dining room. Othniel Marsh lived alone in a mansion he had built on a hill outside New Haven. As he walked up the hill, Johnson had a sense of the loneliness and isolation of Marsh's life, his need for approval, for status, and acceptance. He was shown to the drawing room. Marsh was working there alone, and looked up from a manuscript he was preparing.
"You sent for me, Professor Marsh?"
Marsh glared at him.
"Where are they?"
"You mean the bones?"
"Of course I mean the bones. Where are they?"
Johnson held Marsh's gaze. He realized he was no longer afraid of the man in any way. "Professor Cope has the bones in Philadelphia. All of them."
"Is it true you have found the remains of a hitherto unknown dinosaur of great size?"
"I am not at liberty to say, Professor."
"You are a fatuous fool," Marsh said. "You have squandered your own opportunity for greatness. Cope will never publish, and if he does, his report will be so hasty, so filled with inaccuracies, that it will never attain the recognition of the scientific community. You should have brought them to Yale, where they could be properly studied. You are a fool, and a traitor to your college, Johnson."
"Is that all, Professor?"
"Yes, that's all."
Johnson turned to leave.
"One more thing," Marsh said.
"Yes, Professor."
"I don't suppose you can get the bones back?"
"No, Professor."
"Then it's gone,"
Marsh said wistfully.
"All gone."
He returned to his manuscript. His pen scratched on the paper. Johnson left the room. On his way out, he passed a small skeleton of the miniature Cretaceous horse, Eohippus. It was beautifully formed, beautifully assembled, this pale skeleton from the distant past. Somehow, it made Johnson sad. He turned away
and hurried down the hill toward the college. Postscript. Cope. Edward Drinker Cope died penniless in 1897 in Philadelphia, having exhausted his family fortune and his energy battling Marsh. He was relatively young still, only 56 years old, but he had seen the first Brontosaurus skeleton assembled at the Yale Peabody Museum, and more than 1,400 papers published. He is credited with the discovery and naming of more than 1,000 vertebrate species, and more than 50 kinds of dinosaurs. 1. Anisonchus Copehater. He said he named in honor of the number of Copehaters who surround me. He donated his body to science and instructed that after death, his brain size be compared with Marsh's, it being commonly believed at the time that brain size determined intelligence. Marsh declined to accept the challenge. Marsh. Othniel Charles Marsh died 2 years after Cope, alone and embittered in the house he had built for himself. He was buried in the Grove Street Cemetery in New Haven, Connecticut. He and his fossil hunters discovered 500-odd different fossilized animals, including some 80 dinosaurs. He named them all himself. Earp. Wyatt Earp died on January 13, 1929, in a rented bungalow near the intersection of Venice and Crenshaw Boulevards in Los Angeles, after acting in silent movies and then selling the rights to his life story to Columbia Pictures. In later years, he was strongly influenced by the wishes of his wife, Chosie. He told his life story as he remembered it, or chose to remember it, to Stuart N. Lake, a Pasadena writer, 2 years before his death. When published as Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, it made a terrific impression and established his fame enduringly. Sternberg. Charles Hazelius Sternberg became a celebrated American fossil collector and amateur paleontologist who wrote about his time with Cope. He was, in fact, working for Cope when Cope died and learned of his death 3 days later, wired directly by his wife. Sternberg wrote 2 books, The Life of a Fossil Hunter, 1909, and Hunting Dinosaurs in the Badlands of the Red Deer River, Alberta, Canada, 1917. He was responsible for finding the Monoclonius, or as it is commonly known, the horned dinosaur. He quoted Cope as saying, "No man can say he loves us when he wantonly destroys our work. No man loves God who wantonly destroys his creatures." Fossils collected by Sternberg are displayed in museums around the world. Author's note. Biography, observed Oscar Wilde, lends to death a new terror. Even in a work of fiction about individuals long dead, there is reason to consider his sentiment. Readers unfamiliar with this period of American history may be interested to know that Professors Marsh and Cope were real people, their rivalry and antagonism depicted here without exaggeration. In fact, it has been toned down since the 19th century promoted a degree of ad hominem excess that is hard to believe now. Cope did go to the Montana Badlands in 1876 and discovered the teeth of Brontosaurus, essentially as recounted here. Editor's note. Charles H. Sternberg attributed this discovery to Cope in his 1909 memoir, The Life of a Fossil Hunter. Others have credited the discovery of the Brontosaurus to Marsh. The antagonism between Cope and Marsh that played out over 10 years is compressed here into a single summer, with some changes. Thus, it was Marsh who made the false skull for Cope to find, and so on. However, it is true that on many occasions the workers of Cope and Marsh fired on one another, with much more serious intent than suggested here. The character of William Johnson is entirely fictitious. I would not read this novel as history. For history,
read Charles Sternberg's detailed account of Cope's trip to the Montana Badlands in The Life of a Fossil Hunter. I am indebted to E. H. Calbert, the eminent paleontologist and curator of the American Museum of Natural History, for first bringing the story of Marsh and Cope to my attention. In his kind correspondence, he suggested a novel about them. He also provided me with my first leads in his books. Finally, readers who inspect photographic books, as I have done, should be extremely careful about the captions. There has emerged a new breed of photo book in which authentic pictures of the West are accompanied by bleak, elegiac prose. The captions may seem to fit the pictures, but they do not fit the facts. This sad, melancholy attitude is a complete anachronism. Towns such as Deadwood may look depressing to us now, but they were exciting places then, and the people who inhabited them were excited to be there. Too often, the people who write captions to photographs indulge their own uninformed fantasies about the pictures and what they mean. All the events of 1876 occurred as reported here, except that Marsh did not lead a party of students west that year. He had gone every year for the previous six, but remained in New Haven in 1876 to meet the English biologist T.H. Huxley. That all of Cope's bones traveled safely on the Missouri steamer, and no one continued on to Deadwood, and that Robert Louis Stevenson did not go west until 1879. The descriptions of the Indian Wars are accurate, sadly so, and from a vantage of some 100-plus years later, it seems safe to say that the American West described in these pages, like the world of the dinosaurs long before, was soon to be forever lost.
Afterword written and read by Sherry Crichton. Michael's dedication to his craft was endless. Over the course of his 40-plus year career, he wrote 32 books. His work inspired many films, and as a director, screenwriter, and a producer himself, he created iconic movies and television programs. Not only was he always working on his next project, he was always working on his next projects. Michael was constantly reading, clipping interesting articles, and amassing research for new works by looking to the past, observing the present, and thinking about our future. He loved to tell stories that blurred the lines between facts and what-if scenarios. You always came out of a Crichton novel, film, or television event smarter and wanting more. Because his work was so densely researched, you couldn't help but believe that, yes, perhaps dinosaurs could be brought back to life through DNA found in a well-preserved mosquito, or that nanobots could operate intelligently and independently and wreak havoc on their human creators and the environment. His work is as relevant and engaging as ever, as demonstrated by the gigantic success of the Jurassic Park franchise and in HBO's reimagining of his classic film, Westworld. Honoring Michael's legacy has been my mission ever since he passed away. Through the creation of his archives, I quickly realized that it was possible to trace the birth of Dragon Teeth to a 1974 letter to the curator of paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History. After reading the manuscript, I could only describe Dragon Teeth as pure Crichton. It has Michael's voice, his love of history, research, and science all dynamically woven into this epic tale. Nearly 40 years after Michael first hatched the idea for a novel about the excitement and the dangers of early paleontology, the story feels as fresh and fun today as it was to him then. Dragon Teeth was a very important book for Michael. It was a forerunner of his other dinosaur story. Its publication is a wonderful way to introduce Michael to new generations of readers around the world, and is an absolute treat for longtime Crichton fans everywhere. Publishing Dragon Teeth has been a labor of love, and I want to thank the following people for their assistance in this endeavor. My creative partner, Laurent Bouzereau, Jonathan Burnham, Jennifer Barth, and the team at Harper, Jennifer Joel and Sloan Harris of ICM, the remarkable team at the Michael Crichton Archives, Michael S. Sherman and Paige Jenkins, and of course our beloved son, John Michael Crichton Jr. Sherry Crichton.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Dragon Teeth, a novel by Michael Crichton. This program was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring. Copyright 2017 by Crichton Son, LLC. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.